Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. In today's episode, I have a discussion with George Livadas, founder of Upslope Capital. George follows a long-short strategy and he explains why during the episode. We also go over other topics like the current market environment, the characteristics of a high-quality company, the role of luck in investing, and George's most significant mistake. I recommend visiting Upslope Capital website, which is linked in the show notes. And I also recommend visiting bestanchorstocks.com, my investment research service focused on high-quality companies. Link is also in the show notes. Before jumping right into the episode, let's hear from today's sponsor, Public.com. Heads up, folks, interest rates are falling, but you can still lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account at Public.com. That's a pretty big deal, because when rates drop, so can the interest you earn on your investment. A bond account allows you to lock in a 6% or higher yield with a diversified portfolio of high yield and investment grade corporate bonds. So while the others are watching the return shrink, you can sit back with regular interest payments. But you might want to act fast, because your yield is not locked in until you invest. The good news, it only takes a couple of minutes to sign up at public.com. Lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account. Only at public.com/bestanchorstocks. Brought to you by Public Investing, member FINRA plus SIPC. As of the 26th of September 2024, the average annualized yield to worst across the bond account is greater than 6%. Yield to worst is not guaranteed. Not an investment recommendation. All investing involves risk. Visit public.com/disclosures/bond-account for more info. So welcome to another episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. This time I'm lucky to have George Livadas from Upslope Capital Management with me. So welcome to the podcast, George.
Thank you, Leandro. Happy to be here.
I think it's best if we start maybe with an introduction of yourself and your career in the investment industry and how or why you decided to start Upslope Capital.
Sure. So like a lot of people, my career kind of started out, I'd say more in the investment banking world. Sort of think of that as the first half of my career. So I did come out of college. I worked in sort of a securitization group for a few years, eventually went back to business school, coincidentally during the financial crisis. I'll kind of go back to that later, but that's really where it was sort of a late bloomer, but really where I kind of, I'd say, fell in love with the investing world and picking stocks and trying to figure out markets. After that, continued doing investment banking for a little bit, went to work for Bank of Montreal in New York City in the financial institutions group. And that was just traditional investment banking. Sounds kind of funny to say it, but our group that I was in, so we covered financials, but we did everything except for banks. So I spent a lot of time covering exchanges and brokers and asset managers and firms like that, but not really the traditional financials that most people think of. And then I'd say after a few years of that, I really kept thinking back to my time really during business school where, as I mentioned, I sort of started to fall in love with investing and picking stocks and realized that that was what I wanted to do. And, you know, I wanted to kind of get back to that goal of investing. And so I asked to be transferred into the equity research department at BMO and was open to covering a new sector. And fortunately, they had just hired a great new analyst covering the paper and packaging sector. Wasn't something that I was seeking out, but I thought it was a great opportunity to kind of learn something new and had a really great experience there. Given that it was kind of late and my process getting over to the buy side, I did that for about a year. And then, you know, for personal reasons, moved from New York City to Denver and kind of simultaneously went to work for a startup long short fund. After doing that for about a year, decided to start Upslope, or at least sort of start the strategy that would become Upslope, eventually split off on my own and formally formed Upslope.
Mm-hmm. And was it hard starting Upslope? I mean, one of the things that I have friends who tell me, like, maybe you should go into fund management or whatever. But one of the things that I struggle with is that starting a new fund is pretty complicated, right?
Yeah, I'd say the hard part is in the, you know, unless, so I think of myself as not coming from a traditional buy side background. I think there's sort of two different ways that someone like me I came from in some ways a non-traditional background. So I only worked 1 year on the buy side and had kind of an investment banking and sell side career before that. So I was kind of taking a leap of faith in the early years versus a more traditional background where somebody works for a big fund for a long time and maybe starts off with a large chunk of AUM, you know, from day one. And that, you know, certainly that wasn't the case for me. So I think to get back to your original question, it's easy to start a fund. The hard part is in the sort of time frame and the ramp up, especially for non-traditional folks. It takes a really long time to build a track record. And I think that's the hard part. It's easy to open your doors and start, but you really have to kind of think through how are you going to get to a 5-year track record and kind of survive all that time and still be enthusiastic and happy about what you're doing.
And what do you think from your years working for the sell side?
Listen.
What lessons do you take now as a fund manager from that period?
That's a good question. I mean, it was really different. I think, you know, I spent when I was on the sell side, most of the time I was on the investment banking side of the wall. And I think, you know, now that I think back to some of the analysis I might've done as an associate on like potential IPOs and, you know, valuation work. And I think I was pretty naive back then about what drove valuation. And I think that the frameworks are just much more simple than I think things sort of work in the real world. And then I think, you know, when I moved into research, I guess the one thing I took away from moving into sell side research was I think it gets a little bit of a bad rep kind of unfairly. You know, I actually thought it was a really interesting, exciting job. You got to cover a sort of small, finite, manageable universe of stocks, become an expert on those particular stocks and get to talk to hedge funds all day about them. You really develop an understanding for what moves stocks and what people care about. Some of those things I think are less glamorous than most people might think. I'd say even today, I'm still kind of amazed at how much sell side calls up or down can move a stock in a given day. Sometimes there's something groundbreaking in a sell side report, but most of the time, just a simple upgrade or downgrade, moving a stock on valuation alone. I'm amazed that actually does anything in markets today, but it does.
Yeah, it does. And now jumping into your investing strategy, I think this is quite a broad question, but how would you describe your investing strategy?
Yeah, so I, you know, when I started, I really had one of my big motivations for starting Upslope was I felt passionately about my own investment philosophy and thought that it would be really hard to go find someone else that had the exact same philosophy that I would want to work for or with. So I viewed it as kind of having a blank slate and, you know, being able to love the opportunity to create something that matched my personality perfectly. My strategy is really kind of a classic long short equity strategy. I focus mostly on mid caps, mostly US, but a fair amount, typically 30 to 40% of the long portfolio is non-US, so mostly developed Europe and relatively concentrated, although it's, and I can get into this later, but it's become less so over time. Generally, my biggest long positions could be kind of 9 or 10% or more. And then on the short side, much more diversified than that.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I struggle the most with in the investment industry is that a lot of people talk about returns,
yep,
but not a lot of people talk about risk. And you can also see this in people who are not fund managers themselves, but are clients of those fund managers. They'll probably chase more returns and they won't care too much about risk. But you're one of the few fund managers that I have seen actively discussing the concept of risk and how you try to minimize it so that we should not focus only on returns. How do you measure risk and how do you try to minimize it?
Yeah, I think there are a few different ways. I mean, I think the biggest, most important thing I think is just common sense. It's obvious to me, you know, somebody who's running a 20%+ positions that are 20% or more in, you know, again, kind of know it when you see it, but, you know, really risky speculative stocks, like that's a sign of really high risk. For me, I think in terms of measuring it, I focus a lot on the Sortino ratio, which is basically a Sharpe ratio, but focused on downside standard deviation. And I think I'd say this is another thing that sort of gets a bad reputation, I think, unfairly. People tend to take shots at the Sortino or Sharpe ratios as being overly academic. And while I agree that they're, you know, you can't just look at a ratio and come to conclusions purely based on the numbers, I still think they're, you know, they're sort of the best tools. Although flawed, they're still the best tools we have available. So, a good approach is to look at a track record with, you know, look at the Sortino ratio or Sharpe ratios, and then also look at the qualitative aspects of how the manager is going around, you know, picking stock, constructing a portfolio.
And now everyone has believed historically that indices are highly diversified, right? So they're a great investment vehicle, but now maybe we are seeing that they are quite concentrated among max seven or the top 10 companies. Would you say today that your portfolio, or would you consider your portfolio to be less risky than the indexes today? Let's say the S&P 500.
I think so. I mean, there are some factors where you could argue it's riskier, but I think in general, overall, it's less risky. So what I mean by that is, so net exposure of the fund is usually relatively low. So net exposure is, you know, the value, effectively the exposure of your longs minus the value of your shorts. So typically my net exposure has been around roughly 40%. And so by that measure, I think, you know, the fund has a lot less, you know, market risk than the overall market. In terms of gross exposure, you know, I do use some leverage. So the fund is about 150% gross. So by that measure, I'd say there's more overall risk, but it's a different type of risk than just market risk. It's kind of, you know, my ability to pick stocks that are, you know, long or short, that's more the risk than just kind of pure market beta.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we hear today, right, is that the index is concentrated, but probably concentrated across quality companies, right? The Max 7, which are very good businesses. I think quality is quite a subjective term because it depends to some extent, not entirely, but to some extent to what any investor wants to like characterize it as.
Yep.
What are the characteristics you think a quality business needs to have?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's anything, I don't have anything groundbreaking here, but I think I have sort of a, you know, I have a bunch of checklists that I go through in my processes. And when I'm looking at something that I'm trying to figure out, so I'll step back. For longs, I invest in two types of businesses. So what I call core and tactical. Core positions are more quality, like we're talking about here, kind of typical compounder type businesses. And tactical are more traditional value investments, you know, that might be more cyclical or might have some hair on them and an ugly balance sheet or something like that. So when I'm trying to figure out if something is a potentially good core position, to me, my definition of quality is, you know, are there some, first of all, is there a really obvious competitive advantage? I find a lot of folks, you know, they can kind of make up competitive advantages if they want to see them, but I think the advantages should be really obvious and just kind of hit you in the face. So really obvious competitive advantage. Are there some kind of secular trends that are going to help the company grow, you know, pretty much regardless of what GDP is doing, or at least, you know, GDP plus over time? And those should also be, you know, you shouldn't have to be creative to come up with those reasons. It should be obvious. And then I think, you know, a good balance sheet, trustworthy, straightforward management team. I think that's one that I spend a lot of time on, is just kind of reading transcripts and seeing how management responds to, you know, criticism or questions. And, you know, are they straightforward and just kind of telling it like it is, or are they making all sorts of weird adjustments because they're afraid to look bad and, you know, maybe hiding something? And then I think just, you know, again, nothing earth shattering, but, you know, good free cash flow generation, you know, good quality of earnings. And I think I mentioned good balance sheet.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there's something interesting, right? Because I think a lot of people tend to think they need to find something original or something that's maybe not apparent, but in the end, you see that the companies that have performed very well over the long term pretty much had competitive advantages that were there to see. So this probably begs the question of, what do you think your edge is? So if the characteristics are so apparent, why do you think the market at times will misprice these companies?
I think mispricings exist usually, probably just mostly for different time horizons and people overemphasizing current temporary problems. You know, like I recently wrote up an investment in an exchange, you know, a large financial exchange. And, you know, my thesis there was that the market was temporarily, you know, too focused on a potential new competitor, even though it's a sector that has for decades, you know, the incumbents kind of keep winning for the most part. And there's this nonstop stream of startups that have cried over the years, but it's incredibly hard to break into. But despite that long history, people still get overly focused on kind of the short-term risks and just the obvious things.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. I remember the name of the fund manager right now, but there was a fund manager who said that most of the best investments he'd made was probably in secular companies that were going through a cyclical swing because the market would completely forget that the secular trend was there and basically nobody would want to own it while it was going through the cycle. So I think the timing aspect is actually an advantage, even though a lot of people would say, well, that's well known, so it's not an edge, but I do think it's an edge.
Yeah.
So now into another topic, that is shorting. Mm-hmm. The thing I have with shorting, right, is that when I understand investing in companies as an asymmetric bet, right, because you can have all the upside, but then your downside is capped. And that's why a lot of people say, like, well, Buffett has great returns. He's never wrong. Well, no, actually, Buffett has been wrong quite a few times, but he's taken advantage of the unlimited upside while obviously protecting his downside.
Yeah.
What do you think are the advantages of shorting, or why do you use shorting in your strategy?
Yeah, I think the biggest reason is it gets to what my actual goal is of the strategy. So I think I kind of skipped over it when I described what the strategy focuses on, but the goal of the strategy is to deliver, you know, effectively equity-like returns, but with lower volatility and, you know, lower market risk. And so it's a smoother ride versus the indexes over time. To me, adding shorts and short selling exposure is, at the very least, it's sort of this very simple blunt tool to reduce correlation to indexes. Obviously, it does so in a pretty complicated and often challenging way. But I think, you know, it's the ability to get longer in some ways. It protects against downturns in the market overall. And I think to get back to your comment on, you know, sort of skewing the risk reward for, you know, unlimited upside and downside, I think my sort of pushback on that mindset in general is that I think if you look at some of the data across like the universe of stocks broadly, most stocks are actually pretty bad. So, and there's a study, I can't remember, as JP Morgan or forgetting who did the study, but there've been a bunch of studies that basically say, you know, effectively, I think 2/3 of stocks underperform the index over their lifetime, or I think maybe even worse than that. And something like 40% of stocks have a negative return over their lifetime. So to me, it's actually in some ways, although easier said than done, you know, in some ways there's a pretty big pond to fish in for kind of bad companies that will at least underperform over time.
Hmm. That's actually a good point. So if you were to throw darts to the S&P 500 and you throw darts to short companies, you'll probably be more right than when you're throwing darts to find the next compounder.
Well, I think the important thing is you want to be really sure that you don't accidentally hit, you know, the next Microsoft or Amazon or something like that. But I think some people, especially people that don't short sell regularly, I think what they forget a lot of the time is you don't have to stick with a short forever. I mean, there's no rule that says you have to, once you're short, stay short for 10 years. So, you know, you can conclude that you're wrong and move on, and that's okay. And I think, you know, I'd probably add like another really important aspect of short selling. I think half of the whole game for short selling is position sizing, even more so than longs, and kind of getting it right and just focusing more on, I'd say, like I said, just kind of making sure that you miss those big winners on the short side and focus on everything else, all the other junk.
And one of the things that's most important for maybe an investor, and there are widely different ways of doing this, is sourcing ideas. I mean, with any investor's bandwidth, unless you are a large investment bank or a very large fund and you have a lot of analysts at your disposal, is that basically you have, let's say, I don't want to sound like I work as a slave, but you have 12 hours in your day to research. So obviously you cannot get to every company. So how does your idea generation process work?
Yeah. So I split it up into a bunch of categories. So some of the biggest categories are, I'd say, just areas that I have expertise in and experience in. So I mentioned my time in investment banking, I covered financials, you know, non-bank financials in particular. And then when I was on the sell side, I covered the packaging sector. So at any given point, compared to most funds, I have concentration in those two kind of random areas, but you know, they're random, but they work for me because they're uncorrelated with each other. And I think for a bunch of reasons, I think both really good sectors for long, short investing. So always have something there. I also look at transactions a lot for ideas. So M&A, SPACs and IPOs, obviously have been kind of, or SPACs in particular, were a good source of short ideas for a while. And then the other categories I have are sort of more general. So sometimes I'll just look at the portfolio and kind of say, okay, you know, what's missing from the portfolio? Am I too heavily, you know, too overweight defensives, or am I too overweight cyclicals? Could I use something in one of the other areas? You know, am I missing some healthcare? What would be kind of additive to the portfolio? So sometimes I'll just, you know, I'll kind of do a targeted search for something that would help the portfolio. And then the other category I'd mention is I'm kind of a big believer in just kind of pursuing what's interesting. So I call it the walking around method. So walking around the grocery store and just paying attention, keeping your eyes open. And, you know, if you find an interesting stock, just go research it and kind of keep going with it. And if it's a good idea, great. If not, you know, you obviously haven't lost anything. You now know about another company that you wouldn't have known about before.
Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, have you ever been long and short the same company in a given period? So do you find synergies between both?
Yeah, it's probably been more common where I've been long something and then flipped to short, where I think, you know, I've found that if you have a very clear thesis, you know, there's a very clear long thesis and you can very clearly see that thesis break. And, you know, as somebody who's had that happen before, you know, when it happens, you're kind of frustrated and upset and angry. And I think you can turn that situation around and flip short in certain cases where there's a really clear thesis break, where I think, you know, it's obvious that there's going to be a long line of people heading for the exits because there's a well-known thesis and it's such an obvious break to it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about after the idea generation, you have your investment process. Mm-hmm. Are you very strict with it or are you flexible? I mean, I know investors who would say, I have to do X, Y, Z before I ever consider a company, but maybe some of them would say, okay, only doing X in this company is enough. So are you flexible or do you tend to stick to some guidelines?
I'd say a little bit of both. I mean, I definitely have a pretty simple process, you know, where it's kind of reviewing the typical filings, like the K and recent Qs, you know, reading or listening to recent calls, going through kind of a detailed model of a company. But I'm definitely open to, you know, there are, I think it's the famous Soros quote of invest and then investigate. There are definitely cases where I'm open to investing relatively quickly, you know, where I've kind of gone through some of those steps, but definitely not all of them. And I need to eventually get to those steps. But, you know, if events are moving quickly, you know, there have been certain cases where I can think of where, you know, a company going through a turnaround maybe hires some important person, you know, or several important people. And it's really obvious that really important change is happening. And so I might want to move quicker than I would be able to if I had to check off every single box first. But, you know, I'm comfortable doing that. And then if I go trying to check off all those boxes and I don't like what I see, then I'm okay to leave and move on to something else and, you know, don't feel like it has been done.
One of the things I believe is probably the most important thing in investing, right, is learning to say no, because there's this component of sunk costs when you've studied a company. So how do you manage that after you, Like, do you find it challenging to say no to a company? Do you think that tends to happen early during your research process? Or do you find times where you get to the end of your research and then you end up saying no?
I think I have a pretty easy time saying no really fast, really early. For whatever reason, I find, you know, when I go to ideas dinners or, you know, things like that, I have a hard time, you know, getting past the first couple minutes of a pitch where, you know, I can kind of think right away, okay, this is not going to fit with my portfolio or my process or, you know, style in some form. And so I'm going to pass on it right away. And, you know, I think maybe being biased as kind of being a short seller, you know, that I'm always looking for red flags. And frankly, I'm probably bothered by red flags more than I should be sometimes. But, you know, I think it does mean that I probably pass on things quicker and, you know, maybe more than most people, especially in the early rounds of, you know, going through a 10K or something.
Mm-hmm. I think that the thing with the red flags is that many times you'll see maybe not a red flag, but an orange flag. And then you'll say, okay, I don't think it'll be important. But then at some point during your investment career, that red flag, that orange flag will turn into a red flag and then you'll suffer the loss. I think it's important to not make exceptions, especially because you don't need to, right? If you have a portfolio, you don't need to own everything. So that's one of the best things about investing, that you can be super specific with what you want to own and what you don't want to own.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's this ongoing discussion, I'd say, well, this is a forever discussion in the market, but lately you've seen it more and more between small, mid and large caps or mega caps. So yep. Which one is the factor that's right now, obviously it's all about large and mega caps. And then people are expecting a resurgence of the small caps or mm-hmm. whatever. You said before that you invest, well, the sweet spot is mid caps.
Yep.
Why do you think that's a sweet spot in the market?
Yeah, I think for me, there are a few factors. So one, I think it's where I have experience. So that's sort of why, one of the reasons I landed on you know, focusing on mid caps. So it's where I have experience. I think it's, in general, I think of once a company has made it to mid cap, obviously this isn't a scientific comment, but once a company has made it to mid cap, I think almost by definition, they're sort of in a better pond, you know, where there's a lower likelihood of fraud. There's a higher likelihood that it's a real business, that there's at least some durability to it. And, you know, to me that mid caps, I think in general, you know, there's frankly just more movement, you know, companies go up or down more than at least I think most large caps. And to me, that's a good thing in terms of trying to find good ideas that generate returns long or short. And then I think, you know, it's definitely not a knock on the large cap opportunity set, but I think from a business standpoint, you know, I think it's really easy to get large cap exposure, you know, through ETFs definitely encourage my clients to maintain large cap exposure, but you know, I don't think they don't need it for me. So
what would you consider mid caps? Because I see a lot of people using the same, let's say, ranges as 30 years ago, and basically not taking into account inflation or anything.
Yeah, I think it's hard. I try to not be too scientific about it. No, you know, I think to me, the more important thing probably is cutting off like the tails. So like cutting off what's an obvious large or mega cap. And to me, that's something that's like 50 billion and up. $30 billion company is, it's very arguably a large cap, but it's not the same thing as Google or Amazon by any means. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I think, you know, a $1 billion company is arguably a mid cap, but I think probably not. I think, you know, so I think to me, it's mid cap is probably something in like the, you know, three to 20 billion range. And then you've got kind of a buffer on each end. I try not to be too hardcore about defining it. And, you know, I want the portfolio to, you know, the sort of bullseye of the portfolio to be mid cap. And, you know, more than anything, I just want it to look different than the indexes and other hedge fund portfolios.
Sorry to take you away from the episode, but let's hear again from today's sponsor. Heads up, folks, interest rates are falling, but you can still lock in a 6% or higher yield with a diversified portfolio of high yield and investment grade corporate bonds on public.com. you might want to act fast because your yield isn't locked in until the time of purchase. Lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account only at public.com/bestanchor.
Do you tend to care about how followed the company is? So say a mid-cap that's 10 billion, probably that's in reach for several funds and probably has analyst coverage. Do you care about that or do you tend to be more neutral?
I mean, I definitely have a bias towards at least what I think are underfollowed companies. And it's, I can't say I'm always right about how, you know, under the radar they are, but that's at least kind of my bias is I try to look for ideas that haven't been written up a bunch of times on Value Investors Club and Twitter and elsewhere, you know, for better or worse, that's my style.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I tend to see when I see people talking about small caps is that they tend to think that just because a company has a low market cap, then the opportunity is large. But obviously that's not the case because they may be catering to a niche and maybe they're highly penetrated. What would you say are some of the risks or the main risk of investing in small caps?
I mean, I think, again, probably biased by being a short seller, but I'd worry about fraud and just, I mean, more than anything, I think probably fraud is even too strong of a word, but I'd probably worry more about a company that is kind of pretending to be or has been interpreted as being a quality company. And really, it's just a cyclical company going through a good time. And I think you saw a ton of that in, 2021, where there were cyclical companies that were just having unbelievable boom times. And you investors could kind of work themselves up into a frenzy, convincing themselves that this is actually this, really low quality business is actually a really incredible compounder. And if you look at the chart of their financials, look how amazing they are. And sure enough, they turned out to just be cyclical businesses benefiting from stimulus spending and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And in your investment tenets, which I will probably, I'll link your website in the description because I think that's actually a very good idea to list your investment tenets. And I imagine that you update that as you go on.
Yep. Every 6 months.
Okay, perfect. That's actually a very good idea. So you mentioned that you buy with the intention of holding forever, which is not the same as buying to hold forever. So how usual do you feel this has become in your portfolio? I mean, have you held something since the inception of the portfolio till today? Or have you rotated the portfolio more than you would have expected?
I'd say both. So I'd say turnover is probably higher than I would have expected at the outset of the strategy. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but that is what it is. And at the same time, I have one position I've held since the beginning of the strategy, or effectively, I think it was 2 months into the strategy I bought it. So for over 8 years, I was looking at, of the top five longs. So one of them I've held for 8+ years, one is about 5 years. And then I think two others are about a year, and then one is, a quarter. And so I think in general, I'd say the top of the long book tended to hold longer. And they sort of earn their way up to the top of the book. And then the bottom of the long book, I think, rotates a lot more. I think, again, kind of getting back to the invest and then investigate concept where, I'm comfortable putting on a small position and kind of continuing to research it. And then if it doesn't go well, then I kind of get rid of it. And then other times, I have a position and everything goes well in the research process and I own it for a quarter or two, and then something bad happens that kind of messes up the thesis. And I'm pretty quick to move on, if I feel like the thesis has been broken.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. So I imagine that if the thesis has been broken, obviously you sell your position. Do you ever sell for valuation reasons? And if you do, what has to be, let's say, the valuation gap to the upside that you consider selling that position?
Yeah. So I mentioned I have the sort of two categories of longs. So for core, maybe I'll start with the tactical. So tactical, again, are the more traditional value stocks. For tactical positions, I will sell due to valuation because I don't really view them as forever. They tend to be more cyclical companies. I'm betting on like a cyclical upturn or, betting on a trough in their markets. And betting on valuation improving, but it's not going to, again, these are not kind of hold forever compounders. So I try to be really disciplined with valuation for those companies. And once the stock kind of gets pretty close to where I think it's worth, I start selling and, you know, maybe even sell the whole thing. For the more compounder type stuff, I try as hard as I can not to sell just because of valuation. So I try to just, you know, leave them alone and not mess with them as much as possible. But, you know, there are definitely times where valuation can get crazy enough where I've been, you know, felt forced to sell. So years ago, I owned a company called Market Access. And I think at one point it traded for, I want to say up to, you know, 45 or maybe even 50 times EBITDA. And so that was what I had owned. I think I had owned it for 5 years, probably, you know, probably since inception of the strategy. And it was, I think that was sort of the first real test of that, you know, how well can I sit still and not sell something that I think is, you know, it's a good company and it's doing well, but valuation is clearly in crazy land. I think in that case, you know, I did sell a fair amount of it, you know, because it was out of control.
One of the things that I think is probably not discussed enough is probably a topic of mistakes. I mean, if you go in social media, or it doesn't need to have to be social media, the media itself, like television, you'll see a lot of people talk about successes. So then it becomes a huge echo chamber because everyone is making money on everything. But one of the things that I was telling my wife the other day is that probably one of the toughest things about investing is that you have, let's say you have a 15 stock portfolio, and you know that at least there's going to be maybe 30% of mistakes, but you don't know which at that moment, right? But they are there, you know it. So how do you, what's your process to realizing that you've made a mistake? And one of the things that I think that also is not discussed enough is that sometimes we can make money on a stock, not for the reasons we thought initially would create that upswing, right? So do you also look in your successes to understand if your thesis has played out or not?
Yeah, so I think in terms of looking for mistakes, I mean, I think to me, it's a combination of a few things. So at a really simple level, I mean, just monitoring, you know, how a stock has done since I purchased it versus a relevant index. And to me, that's a really simple kind of quantitative way of saying, okay, is at least the share price, is that kind of, has it been a good call or not so far? And that doesn't tell you about whether you are actually right or not, but it can kind of raise a red flag if, you know, maybe something's kind of gone wrong. Or to your point, you know, it might not tell you anything because maybe you just got lucky so far. So I think monitoring performance versus an index is one way to kind of keep track. And then just having a really clear, concise thesis for every position. And by clear and concise, I mean, you know, two or three bullet points on why you own the stock and why you actually, you know, want to continue to own the stock. And, you know, not a 20-page report, but again, two, three, maybe four or five bullet points on why you own it. And just constantly stare at that list and kind of check against what's actually happening in the market and what's happening with the business. And to me, you know, if you kind of do those two things, you can always keep track of, you know, how things are going and whether things might be off course, whether the stock is doing well or not.
Mm-hmm. And what role do you think that luck plays in investing? I mean, if I were to ask you over the next year, how much, what component of luck and skill do you think your returns are going to have in the mix?
That's a good question. I don't know if I could break down, I don't know if I have a number in mind, but I mean, I definitely think luck is, you know, plays a big part. I think in both directions. I mean, I think you can have good luck and bad luck. And I think, you know, month to month, there's definitely a lot of noise from it, but it's tough to say exactly how much, but definitely agree that it's a lot, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. And what has your biggest mistake been? Doesn't necessarily have to be a company. Maybe it's an investment mistake based on strategy or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, so I'd say a few things. So biggest investment mistake. So I think I was short Tesla, I think in 2018, 2019, I forget exactly when it was. And although I covered and survived just fine, I consider it sort of one of my biggest mistakes, or maybe my biggest investment mistake, mostly because I think it was just a big distraction. So it wasn't so much that it was, you know, there was obviously financial loss, but more than anything, it sort of taught me that you need to, with shorts at least, you need to, probably with longs, you need to really consider the sort of mental cost of, mental and just distraction cost of any position. So if you find yourself focused on one position all the time, it really needs to be worthwhile. And almost all the time, if you're focused on one position for a long time, it's not worth, you know, kind of worth damage. I think in terms of biggest general mistake, I mean, I think, so this is a sort of portfolio construction mistake. So I think I started out with gross exposure that was too low. So I mentioned, you know, I have relatively a low net exposure. And I think it took some time for me to appreciate that given that I have low net exposure, I should have higher gross exposure just because it's pretty tough to make, you know, to make really attractive absolute returns with both low net and low gross exposure at the same time. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of need to have one or the other, but you can't have both. So that's something I sort of remedied a couple of years ago. I wrote to my investors and, you know, let them know that I was going to be increasing gross exposure a little bit.
And let's talk about the current market, right? I mean, many people have been claiming for several years that we're going to have a recession or a hard landing. We've not had that yet. And then, but now a lot of people are saying that markets are on the expensive side, which I think that there's no debate around that, but that we are in for a very rough decade of returns. What are your thoughts around that? And do you take into account, to what extent do you take into account macro forecasting when investing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think about it because I'm human, but I try not to. Right. I try to focus on, you know, bottom-up work and let that kind of guide the exposure of the portfolio and the types of things that I'm investing in. But again, I'm like everybody else, you know, we all read the same things and it's hard not to have our own opinions and biases. I think in general, you know, I agree that markets look awfully expensive. I look at my own longs and, you know, there isn't a whole lot that gets me all that excited today. And, you know, I feel comfortable with it because I have the shorts and hedges and everything in place. But, you know, when I look at the two sides of the portfolio, I definitely feel better about, you know, the outlook for the short side versus the long side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you might have been referencing the Goldman, it was a Goldman piece, I think.
Or JP Morgan. Yeah, I think it was Goldman.
Someone recently said, yeah, that we'd have kind of a lost decade. And to me, it seems plausible, but it's not something I would ever bet on. I mean, I think in general, when I think of the macro picture, I try to, it's almost the opposite of kind of the long-term view on it, on an individual stock. I try to look around corners and say, okay, what are the risks that I see in the next 3 months or 6 months? It's not, you know, I'm not going to make some, you know, a grand forecast on what the S&P 500 is going to do for the next 10 years or 5 years even, because I just have no idea. But I think, you know, I can kind of, you can always look ahead a little bit and say, okay, these are the things that people are kind of worried about today. Some of these are probably overblown. Some of these are probably people aren't paying enough attention to. And, you know, in general, I try to think of, you know, what are the scenarios that I'm actually afraid of, you know, on behalf of my portfolio, you know, what would hurt the portfolio? And I try to come up with ways to protect the portfolio in those situations, even if, you know, even if they might not seem all that plausible in the market.
I think one of the, a lot of people right now are probably making too many generalizations, right? I mean, we've talked before about the skewness of the market into several companies, that the overweight of 10 companies. So obviously, I think personally that there are pockets in the market that are not expensive just because the index returns have been driven by a handful of companies. But a lot of people tend to go with the market is expensive, right? But in reality, some parts of the market are definitely more expensive than others. So do you... What's your view on the generalizations we're getting every day now, and how do you protect against making those generalizations yourself, right? Because it's the easy thing to do, say, okay, the market's expensive, but in reality, the underlying truth maybe is different.
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think I agree with, unfortunately, I agree with some of the generalizations. But I think, you know, just trying to focus as much as I can on individual companies. I guess where I say I agree with the generalizations, that to me, that comment is driven by the fact, by observing my own companies. So the companies that I follow, you know, so the generalization that the market is pretty expensive, I see some confirmation in that when I look at the companies that I tend to follow. But, you know, it's definitely not an absolute statement. It doesn't mean that there isn't value out there. As someone who invests a lot in Europe, I mean, I definitely see value in, you know, I'd say more so in Europe than in the US, since there are opportunities, but I think they're harder to find than, you know, the Europe.
Well, one of the things that I struggle with there is that some people will say, okay, these companies are not expensive, so I'm more protective if the S&P 500 goes down. But at the same time, I think that if the S&P 500 has a, let's say, double financial crisis moment, then liquidity will probably be absent everywhere. So even if you're maybe protected for the long term, but it's going to be tough to avoid the crash in a stock, even if it's cheap, everything goes down, right? Because everything right now is, let's say, dominated by passive flows. And so for me, that's the tough part when I see, like, that's what I tell people who claim, okay, this company is cheap, so then my downside here over the short term is protected. And I'm not quite sure about that.
Yeah. I think the other thing I'd add on that, I agree with you. I think the other thing I'd add is, I think a lot of the seemingly cheap companies are, you know, they're just cyclical. So I think, you know, if the Mag 7 goes down 20%, you know, a cyclical company might be cheap today, but it can go, I mean, we know that they can go much lower than most people tend to fear even. So just because something's trading at 12 times earnings doesn't mean it can't go to 8 times earnings really fast. And it might make it a great buying opportunity at 8 times, but it doesn't really protect you again in that scenario.
And to your point, if it's cyclical, those 8 times earnings probably can go up quite fast, even with a flat or declining stock price.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we're getting here towards the end of the conversation. One last question would be, what's your favorite investment-related book? You probably have like 20 or 30 right now that you're thinking.
I mean, I sort of pick and choose. I sort of think about it like investors that I look up to. I think of different aspects of each one, not any one particular book. But I think, you know, in terms of books that I've enjoyed the most, I think like Art of Execution was a really good, interesting, kind of different book than I think is maybe not. It's reasonably popular, but it's probably not on everybody's reading list. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of about creating a portfolio, managing the portfolio, and really kind of managing positions through, you know, the ups and downs of the market. And it's different than just kind of figuring out which stocks to pick. It's figuring out how to actually manage the position once you have it. So I'd say that's, again, it's a very kind of niche topic in some ways, but I think that was probably one of the most enjoyable books that I can remember.
Not every time I ask for a book and that, like, the guest says a book that I've not read, but I've not read that one. That one I'm going to buy.
It's a really, maybe I'm being lazy, but it's a really easy read too. I mean, it's an enjoyable read, and I think has some, kind of covers a little bit of a different topic, what most people are focused on.
Mm-hmm. Great. So thank you very much, George, for coming to the podcast. I think it was a great conversation. And we also touched on the short side, which I don't typically do in this podcast. I think that's also great.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.